many cities and citizens are taking another look at the issue of lead in their public drinking water in light of Flint. In Pittsburgh, the Water Authority is changing the anti-corrosive additive to help keep lead levels low. Of course, the trouble in Flint started after the city switched to the Flint River for its drinking water. The state of Michigan didn't require Flint to treat water to control corrosion. Without that treatment, lead can leach out of pipes and fixtures. Werner Truskin is an economist at the University of Pittsburgh, and he literally wrote the book on the history of lead in water. I spoke with him earlier this week at his office, and we started the conversation with why we have these lead pipes in the first place.
Lead pipes are pervasive. So if you looked at 50 largest cities in 1900, at least 40 of those used lead pipes. In many of those cities, lead pipes were actually mandated by the building code. It was pliable, it was durable, so you could bend it around and work it around existing infrastructure. Engineers thought of it almost as the Cadillac of pipes, that this is the ideal thing we should use. And then once it was in the ground, in contrast to, say, an iron pipe, a lead pipe would last 2 to 3 times longer. And in fact, the lead pipes that were put in the ground in 1900 are, for the most part, still in use. Occasionally, people would raise health concerns. At the time, there wasn't a deep appreciation for how serious lead could be, and so those concerns were minimized.
Yeah, you write that many doctors and scientists knew that there were health impacts related to these lead pipes, but nothing was really done about it for a lot of years, even into the 1990s in New York. And that had huge ramifications for public health. How is this legacy being felt even today?
Well, historically, most places did not monitor lead levels in water like we do today. The way you would discover lead is much like as you discovered it in Flint, there would be this kind of mass epidemic. One of the most famous instances happens in Lowell, Massachusetts in the 1890s, where they change a water supply, as in Flint, and suddenly adults start coming down with obvious symptoms of lead poisoning. They would exhibit a blue gum line. They'd get these external paralysis in their extremities.
You're making like your hands are like claws.
Exactly. And then I'm trying to make the wrist drop. It looked like your hands would drop a bit from your arms. But you would have a rash of people arriving at doctor's offices like this, and local doctors were initially dumbfounded. Where is all this lead coming from? And then they started measuring water. And there were multiple cases where people were found to be drinking for years water that contained lead levels that were 1,300 times greater than current EPA standards. What does it mean to say the water contained lead that was 1,300 times greater? One way I can do that is to bring up kind of a sad chapter in history, which was that in the late 19th century, early 1900s, women would use lead as an abortifacient. And there were companies that actually mass marketed lead pills. Then you would take the pills to induce the abortion. And they would have a recommended daily dose on the back and say, they would say, take 2 pills. What would happen is people would say, oh, if 2 pills are good, 4 must be better. They would end up in the hospital and they would often die. What I can do is I could go back and I could say, well, look, this is how much lead is in the water. This is how much lead is in the pills. How much water did you have to drink to get the same amount as was in these pills? So if we would go back to Lowell, Massachusetts, you had to drink 8 ounces of tap water a day.
Why weren't officials or politicians concerned about the effects of lead early on?
The focus in the late 19th, early 20th century was on organic pollutants, typhoid, cholera. And in some sense, that focus is entirely appropriate because when you eradicate these diseases, that eradication is associated with large increases in life expectancy. So if we look at the increase in life expectancy, say between 1850 and 1950, these are the largest increases in human history in the Western world. About 60% of that is driven by the introduction of pure water. Another issue was just the complexity of water-related lead exposure. If you have a neutral water supply, a water supply with a pH of around 7, perfectly safe to run that water through the lead pipe. You only have problems when you deviate from neutrality and the water gets really alkaline or really acidic. In 1900, chemists did not fully appreciate and understand the nature of that relationship. And so they would say, well, look, over here in this city, you know, they're using lead pipes. It's perfectly safe. They've been using them for years. City B saying that about City A. The difficulty is City A might have a neutral water supply. Well, City B has a highly corrosive water supply, and they don't fully understand the corrosiveness of that supply. To get back to the point about the long-term effects, What we're able to do is link people across censuses. And so we can say, well, look, you grow up in a place in 1900, uses lead pipes as very corrosive water. And we're able to compare your outcome to a place where there's not so much water lead. And what we can show you is that over, 20, 30, 40 years down the road, if you're joining up for the military in World War II, we can look at scores and intelligence tests. Your intelligence test scores are lower. Mostly what we're finding is that if you grew up in a place with a lot of water lead, there are large, long-term effects on your economic outcomes. You earn less, you get less educational attainment, less likely to own a home. It's important to emphasize the only way you could discover the water lead in the early 1900s is when you had these mass epidemics. You know, these mass epidemics were adults, as I said earlier, were exhibiting these extreme symptoms. To do serious damage to a child, you don't need water lead levels like that. All you need is the child drinking low levels of lead for an extended period of time and then having that outcome later on. Not surprisingly, the effects of water lead are much more pronounced for lower socioeconomic groups.
Well, you can't help but see a parallel to what's happening in Flint just from these stories that you were talking about from the 1800s and the early 1900s, where there was a huge public health crisis that was sort of under people's radar, that people, in particular children, were being exposed to unhealthy amounts of lead. As you've been hearing about the news in Flint, what issues has that brought up for you in terms of your research?
What I think when I think about Flint is it's really a silent epidemic. It's really hard to monitor unless it gets really bad and adults start exhibiting symptoms and you can see them. The effects in children are much more subtle. They take long term to develop. It's a poison that accumulates, right? And so I think what it does is heighten the importance of kind of studying the effects of this long term exposure. For all the research we have on lead, most of that focuses on short term effects and, reduces a child's test scores today. We haven't been trained to thinking about, well, what are the longer term effects? How does this affect the person over their life course? And when you start looking at that data, the story becomes, even more serious.
Werner Truskin is an economist at the University of Pittsburgh. He's author of the book, The Great Lead Water Pipe Disaster. There's more about that at our website, alleghenyfront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple.